Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to episode 130 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode, delighted to be joined by another huge talent, brass musician and arranger, Stuart Prosser, is my very special guest. Now, Stuart is such a talent, a fabulous trumpet and flugelhorn player who played a key role in the Style Council's early years. He joined the band as an honorary councillor in 1984 for the Council Meeting Part 1 tour and stayed all the way up to the Wembley Showbiz gigs at the end of 1985. Throughout his career, he has created music in a wide range of styles. We're talking jazz, classical, pop, and it's a real delight to dig into his memories, including some very special years with the Style Council. He was such a huge part of that live sound, together with Billy Chapman on sax and Chris Lawrence on trombone. Now, sadly, Chris is no longer with us, but it was so nice to hear Stuart's memories of his friendship with Chris as well. We'll also dig into studio recordings, including songs for the number one album, Our Favourite Shop. We'll talk tours across the UK, Europe, Japan, Australia, friendships made, life on the road, and so much more. You're going to love this one. Let's get into it. Stuart Prosser, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Dan. Quite excited to talk about this stuff. As I was saying, it's been fun just sort of dusting off the memory banks.
I love the fact that we're kind of ticking off so many of you that were in the band at that time as well. I mean, it's fascinating kind of hearing your stories from all kinds of different angles from everybody in the band. And what was a really lovely period in everybody's lives from what I can work out, right?
Oh, it really was. Yeah, it really was. And the more I think back on it, at the time it went in such a blink of an eye in a way. But looking back on it, the things that we did, sort of the camaraderie in the band, the energy, the excitement, because we were all pretty young. I mean, some of us were very young, weren't they? I think Steve White was about six or something, wasn't he? We were just really, you know, young musicians keen to, I don't know, just to do something interesting. And it just all seemed to work. It's been lovely listening back to some of your other interviewees that I was lucky enough to play with. And some of the stories they were telling, I was thinking, oh, yeah, slightly different angle on that. But that's what did happen. Great.
I love the fact also Paul's come off the back of such a massive band, The Jam, but the Style Council, like you say, there's so many youngsters involved, but so much faith kind of put in their musical abilities. And you sounded great on stage, on record. It worked, didn't it?
It really did, yeah. I mean, it must have been quite a risk for Paul. I think at the time I didn't think that. I don't think we thought that as individuals. We were all trying to make our mark and learning our craft. And you know, this sort of turbocharged it for most of us, obviously. But I think it must have been quite a risk for Paul to think, well, he could have gone out and just hired session guys day one, couldn't he? Told them what to wear. But there was something organic about what he did with the musicians that he put together. And I think we all felt that we were all feeling our way a bit with this new massive thing. And so it kind of pulled us together. And that was probably a very smart thing psychologically. We definitely felt like we were this unit. We sort of relied on each other, certainly in the very early days when it was a small, tight thing. When we first started doing, you know, the very first shows, and I remember doing gigs in places like Germany in fairly small venues, but the energy and the excitement is like being back in the clubs again, you know. I think, yeah, it pulled everybody together, but it was quite a risk, I think, using relatively inexperienced and young players. But it paid off. Great sound.
And also, I can't work out, was it more luck than judgment? Because the audition process seems to be, I mean, some people like playing a couple of chords and it's like, right, you're in.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. No, I had to work for my, sing for my supper, but not for, no, yeah, it was, I think Dennis Munday was a bit of a ringmaster on some of that too. I think Paul wanted certain musicians. I certainly remember the audition very well because, you know, I got the call, I think it was from Dennis, and was told to be at Solid Bond Studio certain times. So of course, immediately I just dug out every single Weller-related piece of music I could find and tried to learn everything. So, you know, I just thought, right, as long as I can play all this stuff, you know, I should be right. And if I look all right, and they get good. So I turn up at the studio and met Paul and Mick and Dennis. And then Mick and I went into the main body of Solid Bond, and Paul and Dennis stayed in the control room. And I just thought, right, I'm going to have to play something from the massive back repertoire. And Mick asked me the one question I hadn't prepared for. He said, so what do you want to play? Oh, yeah, good point. He said, okay, let's just do a blues jam thing. So we did a blues jam thing, I think, from memory. And I just noodled around over it. And obviously it sounded okay. And I must have looked the part, and that was it. So it wasn't a lengthy process, but it was interesting.
And you learned all the jam back catalogue, did you?
Well, that had brass in, yeah. Yeah. I'd gone back and dug out as much as I possibly could. Obviously, I'd listened to Café Bleu and learned as many of those parts as I could. So actually, when I got the job and we got the first rehearsals, I was all right for a bit because
you'd done the prep. Stuff. Yeah. Now, the thing is, the Style Council wasn't your first introduction to music, obviously, and even actually being on an album. So talk me through the Hampshire Youth Concert Band.
The heady heights of the brass band world. Yeah, I was a brass band trained trumpeter, did sort of up to my grade eights, and then the Hampshire Youth Concert Band. Yeah, I started as third trumpet, going button, button, as you do. And then
that's my favorite bit on the album, I have to say.
Yeah, and you can't beat that. And ended up, luckily, in the end, being the principal for the band. And yeah, we recorded. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that in terms of it. Recording experience, but yeah, we recorded the first day. This is great, my first album at Winchester College in their lovely live hall that they have there. And so it was a bunch of very young, I don't know, God, how old, sort of 15, maybe 16. So that was, yeah, I kind of learned my craft of, that sounds a bit pretentious, but learning to play in a group with other individuals, listen to them, get it right, practice, all that stuff was kind of drilled into me, I suppose, in that brass band discipline, which is a phenomenal discipline. And then I kind of, obviously, I lost my way and ended up doing jazz and pop. But
where you could have been.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. I could have been massive in the brass band world, but no.
Well, and what was it about the love of that instrument? Was that the first instrument that you landed on as a kid?
No, piano was my first instrument, which I loved, and I'm still reliably bad at now. I use it for writing and composing and stuff now, so it helps. But, you know, I wouldn't play it to anybody. I know piano was first, but then when I picked the trumpet up, I think there was a, I can't remember, I just picked the trumpet up, and it just felt like the natural thing. It's a way, it made me feel like I was communicating something. I don't know, it was a really strange thing to say, but because the piano is also, you're using something, whereas the trumpet actually, to me anyway, is part of my body. My face vibrates, you know, it's kind of integral. And so, and in fact, I tell you what it was, one of the brass band players that got me into doing it more seriously. One of the brass band players went off on tour. So as you got more senior, and it was principal, which I got to in the end, a couple of principals before me had gone off on tour with Billy Ocean, if you remember him.
Yeah.
And came back, and he had a trumpet rather than a, because in the brass band days, it was a cornet, you know. He came back with a trumpet, and at one of the brass band rehearsals, he turned up and he got his trumpet out, and he just played. I think he played like four or five notes, and my jaw just hit. I just thought, wow, you can do that with a trumpet. That sound, which is quite different to the brass band, very controlled, you know, very precise, classical. And I just thought, I want that. I want some of that. And so that's when I really then thought, okay, this is something I'm seriously interested in.
And it's not an easy instrument to play It requires an awful lot of effort, particularly if you're thinking about some of these gigs are like, you know, an hour and a half, something like that. It's a lot of focus, but it's also a lot of effort with a small part of your body. I mean, obviously your fingers are involved, but your mouth, lips.
Actually, you say that it's actually more than the small part of the body, because I think I read somewhere that there are 200 facial muscles, or no, 200 bodily muscles involved in playing the trumpet. So obviously you've got this thing called the embouchure here and all the muscles around there. You've got your throat down to your diaphragm, your stomach, your groin, your everything is involved in producing. And it sounds, you know, people go, yeah, sure, yeah, right. No, it does though. It's a physical instrument. So as a part of practice regime, just having just the stamina thing is really important. And of course, when you're 25, that's slightly easier to deal with than when you're slightly older. You know, I need more of a run up at a gig now, but I'm playing regularly, so it's not a problem. But it is a very physical instrument and it is quite tiring. So yeah, shows of an hour and a half are pretty punchy. I mean, physically generally, but also for this part, that's what comes with the territory.
And so then post Hampshire Youth Concert Band, pre Style Council, you were in bands, you were performing live with your mates. How did that work?
Yeah. The brass band thing was in Winchester, Hampshire. I started to meet other musicians. I joined my first ever funk band. It's great. They were called Egg on Legs. I mean, you could make it up, could you? But it was my first horn section. From there, I started listening to proper horn sections like Chicago, Tower of Power, Blood, Sweat and Tears. And I just thought, that's the sound I love. And also at the same time, playing in a little jazz quintet, not really knowing what I was doing, but actually not sounding too bad. And so from there, I thought this was what I wanted to do. And the action seemed to be in London. So eventually, after qualifications and studying and stuff, I went to London to get a job and to be in London, but mainly to play in a band. And within a few weeks, luckily, I'd auditioned for this great, in fact, they're all still mates like 50 years later, but this great soul band called Rye and the Quarter Boys, where I met actually future partners. And in fact, the trombonist who I brought into the Style Council was in that band with me, and Chris Lawrence, who's very sadly no longer with us. And that was kind of full on 3-4 nights a week out in the club pub circuit whilst holding down a day job. And that really did teach me stamina, which I learned I was rubbish at. So that was kind of when I really got into things and doing a lot of sessions. Actually, the horn section from that band, we used to do a lot of section work for other people.
Wow. I mean, that must be so exciting as a young man, kind of like, you know, you're living your dream literally, right?
Yeah. But it's funny. I didn't really think that. I just thought, I love doing this. This is what I'm doing. This is what makes sense to me. I had to do it. It's kind of an outlet. You know, we were out every night, and you know, and the parts when you're in a soul band are you know, similar, but you can still play with them, and there are solo parts and things. So there's enough creativity, but it's this whole idea again. We were in a band, we looked great, and we came out and we hit people between the eyes. It's funny, we did a lot of the circuit stuff with the same bands, and I remember doing one. We were doing like a university gig on one particular stage. And of course, I hadn't met him at the time, but in the next room and the next stage was a band called The Bureau with a keyboard player, one Mick Talbot.
Merton Mick.
Yeah. And Merton Mick. And so we liked them, and I don't know what they thought of us, but so after our set, we rushed in to see them. And we were quite a in your face sort of bang, everyone dancing. But they took it to another level. And they looked fantastic, but they were literally running about on stage, hurtling into each other. And it was the energy of that period.
Brilliant. They sound fabulous. I don't know if I've actually seen any footage of that band properly on like the web and stuff. I'll have to do some digging.
I'm sure it's around, yeah. I can't think who else was in it, but no, that was a great band. It also got me into the whole cultural thing, the network, the sort of the fabric of the session scene, the band scene. And so I was hardened at club level. You know, at working clubs, air force bases, pubs, all that stuff.
Let's go back to the Style Council. So, Dennis, how did Dennis find you? Do you know how he got hold of your details? Knew that you existed?
Years later, I bumped into and I did some work with actually Nick Gatfield. He was quite senior in Polydor, but he became the CEO of Sony Music, I think, later. He told me that he had come across me or seen me or heard me and gave my name to Dennis. So he was in Dexys, Nick Gatfield. So, yeah, so I just got a phone call out of the blue from Dennis one day saying, did I fancy doing a tour with the Style Council?
And from that audition, we're straight into live performance, really, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we rehearsed at John Henry in North London, proper soundstage, lights and everything. So we did, you know, we put some miles in, but pretty quickly. We were, well, I tell you what was the first gig I remember. I think it was the first gig, was it in Chippenham, and it was a Sight and Sound in concert for BBC Two or something. And it was our first gig. I think I'm right saying that, our first gig, and it was live. And also, I had extra pressure because Mick has got this great tune you might have heard of called Le Départ. And Paul had said to me, he always quite fancied having some kind of instrumental passage or melody over it. Could I give it a go? So I'd written this, it's quite a simple tune, but I'd written this tune over Mick's great chord changes and things. And we'd rehearsed it a couple of times. And I mean, to be honest, I played it to the whole band. And I was expecting Paul to go, yeah, that's nice, but how about this? And I played a rehearsal. He went, yeah, okay, good. Next. Okay, so that's happened. So, so not only did we have the first ever gig live on TV, all my friends and family and people could watch, but also, you know, there came a point in the middle of the set where I had to walk out on stage, you know, on my Todd, well, no, with Mick, and do this flugel solo. I tell you, that's the most pressure I think I've ever faced. That's
live to the nation, yeah, on TV and simulcast on radio at the same time. Well, as well,
yeah,
right?
No pressure at all, yeah. It doesn't sound too bad, actually. I've heard it back a bit.
Well, somebody's put that whole gig on YouTube. There's a chap whose name escapes me. I'll look it up and mention at the end of the podcast in the show notes. But he's like converting a lot of the Style Council performances back into like HD and upscaling them. And,
wow, I'd like to see that.
And that's one of them that's now on YouTube. And,
oh, nice.
I mean, everybody looks so fresh-faced and young. It's lovely. But the sound, I mean, from gig one, bang, it sounds fabulous. But the brass was always like a really key part of that sound from day one, even from 83 onwards. It was kind of obviously Paul loves that sound. Yeah, you're an integral part of that performance.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we certainly felt it. We didn't, I mean, the one thing I say about the Style Council is I never, as an honorary counsellor, I never ever felt like a session player. I never was treated like one. You were treated as part of the family, if you like. That went beyond into the sound as well. I think the whole thing was the brass felt integral. It was either adding something melodically, or often it was rhythmically. It was saying something and driving things along. It definitely wasn't icing to me. Anyway, it felt like something really integral. Yeah, and we were allowed to stretch out too. You know, on tunes where there were instrumental parts with just the brass as the lead and then soloing and stuff. So it was quite an unusual sort of band for its time in that way, I think, because a lot of other 80s bands, chart bands, if you want to call them that, I hate to call it a pop band, but it's sort of, you know, we were allowed to do that, to stretch out and say things as musicians within the parameters that were set. So some of the tunes were very straight. You did that, you know, and others you could really sort of let go a bit. And I love that about the band. In soundcheck, I mean, Steve White was obviously getting heavily into jazz, probably more than any of us in those early days before he did his solo stuff. And so for sound checks or in between things, we would just break into some grooves and solo and just, you know, and nobody sort of said, oh, shut up. You know, everybody was like, eh, okay. Yeah, the brass felt like it had something to say, as well as the vocalists, if you like.
Oh, man, how would it be like a fly on the wall during those rehearsals and sessions and just you lot noodling about, but my goodness me, that sounds fabulous.
Yeah, it just felt that's what we did, you know. That's kind of how everyone felt. It's good.
So this was Council Meetings Part 1. This is March 1984. We go on a tour of, straight after that BBC gig that you mentioned, the Gold Diggers in Chippenham, we go on tour of the UK with Europe. And this is the lineup at the time, folks. So obviously we have Mr. Weller, we have Mick Talbot, we have Steve White on drums that you mentioned, but a bunch of fabulous honorary counselors, and many have been on the podcast. So at that time, this is not DC Lee, this is Jay Williamson on vocals. We have Helen Turner on keys, we have Steve Sedelnik on percussion, Anthony Harty on bass, and then on brass we have Billy Chapman on sax, who's been on the podcast as well. On trumpet, Chris Lawrence you mentioned on trombone, who's sadly no longer with us. But that's a big old band, isn't it?
It's a big old band, yeah. And it certainly felt like a big old band when we got to some of the smaller places we played on the continent to start with. But nice to see. It was a serious, unit.
And are you all on one coach? Is going around Europe?
Yeah, all on one coach. And the UK, yeah. We'll pile into the bar. I remember actually, I listened to a bit of Guy Barker's thing. And later on when he joined towards the very end of the sort of the horn based part of the Style Council, yeah, he brought his cartoons along. We used to watch. We used to sit and watch films. I remember watching Clockwork Orange on the coach once, which of course you couldn't get at that time. I think it was sort of a band. Someone managed to get it, as they always do. And we were going to some gig, I think it was the UK, and we were playing this film. And we got to the gig, and no one got out of the bus because we were watching this film. The whole band was sat there, kind of yeah. Wait a minute. Yeah, it was a big old unit to shuffle around. But you know, John Weller, Kenny Wheeler, you know, they kept us in line, let's say.
And the European tour, you also had special guests, Tracy and the Soul Squad. Were you doing any double shifting? Were you part of that at all, or were you solely on the Style Council?
Solely on the Style Council, but Chris and I think Billy did some session recording for Tracy on a couple of her tracks. So, yeah, studio stuff with Tracy, but not live, no.
Not live, no. Okay.
I've only got so much lip.
Well, this is famously the one where Paul broke his wrist as well. So Jay was telling us about that as well, where in a race with her, I think.
That's right. I remember. It was at a petrol station on the way in to Berlin, in memory. So we were in East Germany in this bleak, austere, drab petrol station that, you know, all the food had been there for about 6 months. And we all got out because it had been a long day. And I think it was quite snowy as well, from memory. I think Paul slipped on something. But yeah. Remember that? Everybody just thought it's a sort of, oh, wow. Apart from obviously, you know, worrying about him health-wise, but it's just like, what are you going to do now then without the front man? You know, he blasted through it. He did the gig and arm in a sling, got Robbie's guitar tech to come out and play some of the parts. But I tell you, that the gig that night, that was a punchy gig, because I just think there was so much tension in the band about what would this mean, and concern for Paul, and he was pissed off because obviously he'd it's not what he wanted, obviously. So it was just a really fiery gig. I remember, actually, I'll tell a story. I can tell it because poor old Chris, but that gig, I think it was so fiery that afterwards we always just take turns to put all of what was left from the rider into a plastic sack, put it on the coach. And Chris got to a point, I think everyone was very tired and emotional, but he got to the point where he figured it was Paul's turn to do that. Paul figured it kind of wasn't.
It wasn't ever his turn.
I couldn't possibly comment. But he, anyway, there's this sort of slight kind of, it was an edgy night. It was an edgy night. It was good fun. Yeah, I felt sorry for Paul, but he blasted through it, you know.
Now, we should talk the Style Council on record as well. So I think I'm right in saying the first one that we have an appearance on is this here. This is the 12-inch Groovin', the Style Council. You're there on the Big Boss Groove. Is that
Big
right?
Big Boss Groove. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
what are your memories of being in the studio with the Style Council?
Always really good fun, actually. Very relaxed, highly energetic. It kind of felt right. But I think because we've been on the road before doing that, I think. So we were all pretty tight. It was relatively, again, in memory, maybe not, but I remember it being quite a simple, direct process. Going in, the three of us, and occasionally we had other players join us too. I think Billy sometimes was off with Animal Nightlife, so we had other players would join us for things, which was great. You know, I met some amazing jazz players, guy I've already mentioned, Dave DeFreeze and others, you know, amazing players. You know, it was slightly more organized, slightly more clinical setup than being on the road and, you know, playing live, but it all worked. I think, and it captured that particular track, I think, has captured the energy of the band, even though it's not a live track. It's got the energy.
Now, as we're talking about studio times, we should mention, obviously, this fabulous album, Our Favourite Shops. Here we go. Little reminder, folks. I know it's a podcast, but I like holding them up because they're just such beautiful things, right? The vinyl is just
special. I still buy and play vinyl. I always have, all the way through.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I made the mistake of getting rid of all my vinyl for CD, then getting rid of all my CDs for MP3 because we were all told that was the future.
No, don't do that.
And now I'm buying it all back again at an absolute fortune. So, but there we are, Our Favourite Shop. And you're on the opener of the album, Homebreakers, with that fabulous Mick Talbot vocal. And the closer, Walls Come Tumbling Down, as well. And I think Man of Great Promise on there. You mentioned Dave DeFreeze as well. So he was part of that. You were kind of playing with him alongside him at that time?
I think so. On a couple of, not live, but just some of the recording stuff. Yeah. No, live, it was always, well, until the very last leg of the last tour, when we did Wembley. That had a much bigger horn section with Guy Barker, Mike Moa, et cetera, and string section. But up until that point, it was just really the three of us live. But yeah, but that album did bring in other players. But it just felt like we'd arrived at a different place, actually. It was funny. It felt, I think in retrospect, it was a lot more sophisticated in terms of its thinking and its arrangements. And some of the arranging that John Meeling had written for strings and other things were just really inspired. Great album. I mean, I just love that album.
And there's so much thrown at it in terms of those production values. And the Style Council was selling millions of records around that time, you know, hugely popular. But they must have been quite expensive albums to produce, I would have thought.
I would have thought so, because of the number of people in the band. Absolutely right, yeah. But Polydor, at that point, was standing behind Paul. And I think, you know, was funding that. We were touring quite a lot, so there's money coming in from that, I suppose. So I think it stood up economically. I think it was a number one album in the UK and a number, top something album, top 10, 5 in the US. So I think it was generating returns for the record company. So I'd have thought they'd have been pretty happy at the time, but I don't know the economics.
And on one of the tracks, so Man of Great Promise, flugelhorn. So we're stepping away from the trumpet.
That's always been my sort of go-to second instrument. I carry it always with me. Most gigs I do, it ends up coming out at some point. As I mentioned earlier on, its first outing with the band when I played Le Départ, the solo we mentioned earlier on. So it had always been part of the repertoire, if you like. And I think Paul liked that slightly darker, warmer sound, not quite as sort of percussive as the French horn, but that warmer sound, which I think suits the track incredibly well.
Now back to touring. So there was, just before the release of that album, there was Council Meetings Part 2. And I don't know if you how much this was discussed in the band setup, whether you're all aware of this, but if you look at the program for those gigs, it mentions there being a play instead of musical support. The Three Musketeers Go Wild was going to be the thing. And then, is this right? The main actor broke his leg, so that didn't happen. What do you know about that?
Yeah, this is all a bit vague in my memory. I'm trying to think why. Either it was so traumatic I've blanked it out, or...
Or was it just a wind-up? There was never going to be a play.
Yeah, I can't work it out. I've got that kind of feeling, because obviously, you know, Paul's a mixed sense of humour, I think. You know, they like to keep people slightly on edge and not kind of knowing quite where they were. And I think that was probably more likely what happened. I honestly can't remember now. But I do remember Paul and Mick putting on sort of old raincoats and sort of appearing in front of curtains before we went on and doing something. I certainly didn't understand it then. I'm not sure I do now, but I'm sure the audience had no idea, even if they didn't know it was him, but yeah.
And we were talking off before the podcast recording, we were talking about Billy Bragg being on the podcast and Paul Barry from The Questions being on the podcast, and this kind of lineup where the Style Council would come on first, and then you get Billy and The Questions, and then the Style Council come back on again at the end. Yeah. And it's just being them trying to kind of, you know, just do things differently, kind of push the format, just try and shake things up a little bit.
Yeah, create a different sort of story, I suppose, something that's a bit more, just more interesting than kind of 1, 2, 3 that everyone was so used to back then, I think. Or this, it's gone back to that now, isn't it? It was trying to sort of tell a story, I think, different aspects of things coming out. So that was always really interesting. Actually, Billy Bragg, this suddenly popped into my head. Sounds like a Sun headline, but Billy Bragg flooded my bedroom.
We're going to go into the ad break now, folks. You'll find out more after. No, go
more,
on,
more on that after. No, he was. We got back from a gig near either East Anglia or something like that, and he'd gone upstairs for a bath, run the bath, and either fallen asleep or then gone back down to the bar. And I went back to my room to get something, and all the water was flooding in from the upstairs, and it was Billy in the bar.
love it. Now, we talked about those kind of small clubs across Europe, but things, again, quite quickly go bigger. And we're into Japan, we're into the USA, you're visiting New York, LA, Tokyo. There's this wonderful video, which I absolutely caned, which was Far East and Far Out, completely burnt through that VHS. But was this your first time touring abroad with a band?
Yes, it was. Outside the UK. So Europe was a first, actually playing. And certainly going to somewhere like Japan was just the most exciting thing, as you can imagine. You know, it was quite hard to get there anyway in those days, and expensive. And here I was, you know, effectively being paid to go there, you know, working. I remember actually we got there and we'd all got quite excited on the plane the way over. Nobody slept. Everyone was knackered when we got there, jet lagged, went to do the first show, and it was wasn't the best we'd ever played. And we got a roasting from John, absolute roasting afterwards. You boys, these aren't the exact words he would use. I'll let you use your imagination to fill in the expletives. But he basically said, I think you boys and girls need to kind of get your act together before tomorrow night, or we may all be going home.
Wow. And was that all of you? Was that Paul and Mick in that scenario as well? Everyone
was in the room. It was a bit of a shaky gig. We were knackered. We were young. We didn't, you know, it was, I do remember that. And it was, okay, fine. It was good. The next night, we were on it.
You had no choice.
No, exactly. It was amazing. It was amazing going to those, well, far out places, yeah.
And Anthony, I think, it was talking about, and many of the guests actually talking about that, it kind of almost like Beatlemania at the time as well, like how much.
It was mad, yeah. It was mad. Because we sort of had some of that in the UK a bit. We used to have people being around the hotels we stayed at and that sort of thing. But Japan was a whole nother level. I mean, we literally did have people camping out in the hotel, following us around. If I went into town with Chris, who I used to bunk with, we go walking into town, we'd be followed by people. It's like, we're the horn section. Go and bother the bloke whose name's on the front, you know. But it was very, 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 it was strange, you know. It was amusing. But it was a kind of a mania thing. And I think other kind of others have mentioned to you, you know, in Osaka, we had a stage invasion because people were so keyed up about the band and they weren't allowed to express their enjoyment of music by dancing, oddly. So yeah, it was a quite intense tour, and there wasn't a lot of.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Get up. You know, I've never been a pop star and had that constant attention and hassle I'm sure Paul gets, but I got a bit of a flavour of it then, and it's odd.
Yeah. And was there any part of you that were like, oh, I'd love this, this would be amazing, or was you like, do you know what, that's not for me, that looks hideous?
It's not really my thing, to be honest, no. It's just, no, it's flattering, and you go, oh, okay, someone's interested in the horn section. Beyond that, it sort of gets a bit in the way, really.
But everything I read about Paul, certainly in recent years, it's like he seems to handle that very well, and actually is always up for a photo and a chat and a, you know, it's like, but they must get training. You're trying to do your shopping around Tesco and people are bothering you.
Good about that. He would always talk to people who wanted to talk to him. You know, he's a music enthusiast first, isn't he? Like they are, so... Mm. No, he's always very good about that.
Off the back of our favourite shop, we have festivals. So, and I love all this. So, I mean, at the minute, obviously, the coverage of Glastonbury Festival on the BBC, in my opinion, is worth the licence fee alone. It's incredible. And the great thing is you don't have to go and get muddy and all that. You can just witness every
That's
single...
That's not the attitude, Dan. That's not the attitude.
Because it's like a massive city now. But back in 1984, Glastonbury Festival wasn't so big, obviously, but it was pretty muddy right then.
Yeah, I didn't play that.
Oh, did you not?
I played Glastonbury. Actually, this is really bizarre. I played Glastonbury when I was doing only a few years ago, actually, a classical piece of work that I did, which we can talk about if you like. It's a whole separate thing. But I did Glastonbury playing some classical music. So, no, I wasn't.
You were at that part. So was this Walk Upon England?
Yes, it is. Was. Yes, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, now I'd love to chat about this. Let's finish the Style Council story and then we'll dig into some of that, because I find this is really interesting, folks, of what we're going to talk about in a bit. So did you do any of the festivals across Europe or Live Aid or any of that stuff?
No, sadly, I didn't. Well, we did some of the festivals in Europe, I think. When I say festivals, they were kind of not, you know, muddy fields and stuff. They were kind of indoor things, I think. Bit vague on that. So, no, as you probably know, the Style Council got a sort of older, if you like. It grew. There were times when band went out without a horn section, and there were times when it did. It sort of flexed. And at the time of, well, Glastonbury, it certainly, well, I don't think it was, unless I wasn't on it. Possibly. But certainly for Live Aid, there was a point when the guys were touring, but without horns. So they did Live Aid as part, I think they went off and did another show that day, actually. But
yes, they did. Yeah, you're right. So how much notice would you get of, actually, we're going to need you for this bit? Were you kind of retained anyway? And
No, not at all. No, you know, once a tour had finished, you'd say, you know, you'd go to the end of tour party and go, yep, see you soon. And really have no idea. You know, it could be days, weeks, months, never. That's a good example, because there were no horns, certainly on Live Aid. And then only a few months later, I got the call to say, doing a UK tour, do you want to come on that? And that was the one that ended up as Three Nights at Wembley and became the, I think it's the showbiz thing. And that's when Guy Barker and I were playing horns and stuff. And that was just phenomenal.
But that must be a bit kind of disconcerting as a, yeah, this is your income, this is your living, you're a freelance musician, and you're not a full-time member of a band. And you're like waiting by the phone going, yeah, what's my next gig?
Which is why I actually took another route for a while. I actually went and got, if you like, we used to call it straight work.
A proper job.
He's got a straight gig. Yeah. After the big tours, then I would do session work and things, and that would be fine. Bits and pieces were coming, but it wasn't a lifestyle I enjoyed, sitting waiting by the phone. I like to be active, structured, you know, pushing ahead on things. And so, yeah, I took other work. I then moved into a whole different field, so, which was fine. I worked in corporate affairs for various big institutions, sort of ran functions, but at the same time playing music is sort of, I did think at the time it was schizophrenic, but now I realize it's just a sort of a combination of left brain, right brain that's always worked for me. You know, it's kind of business problems can be jazz problems if you've got to find a way through the chaos, I don't know.
And when you were working in that corporate world, I mean, how many people knew of the those days, the Star Council days and playing Weller and all that? Did you used to get quizzed about it, or did nobody
people did. I didn't use to sort of advertise it, but people would, because I was still playing and gigging and doing the odd session and stuff. People would go, what are you doing tonight at gigging? Oh, and then it would come out. But I do remember I'd got a job actually at Chase Manhattan Bank as a financial analyst, and only like a few weeks in I got a call from Kenny Wheeler going, look, we're doing a UK tour, I know you got this straight gig, could you do it? So you wouldn't need to do the rehearsal. Do one maybe, but you know the stuff. I went, yeah, love to. So I told my new boss had said to me, this whole music thing's out of your system, isn't it? And I was so desperate for a job and money. I went, yeah, of course it is. So then, like, 2 weeks later, can I have my annual leave? So I literally left work on the Friday, did the rehearsal. I can't remember the exact thing, but 2 weeks later or whatever it was, we did Wembley, end of tour, party, get in the car, go home, next day back at the office. And I was sitting there, like, I mean, completely like, ugh, my brain hadn't landed. And this guy walks in the office and just points at me. And I was like, what? He said, I saw you last night. And I was thinking, where was I? Oh, you played at Wembley. He's like, put your voice down. Occasionally it would raise its head, but I did build a career which I've run in parallel with music actually ever since, and it's waxed and waned. And for time I was doing more corporate stuff than I was music, but now I'm doing more music than corporate stuff, and that certainly the last 15 years the balance has swayed heavily back to the music.
I love the fact that the Showbiz Wembley Arena gigs are part of your annual leave.
Yeah, and no one knew apart from that one guy. I told him to shut up, you know. my boss didn't find out, that was fine. Yeah.
So brilliant. The thing about those gigs was, I mean, that was the biggest the band had been, in the sense that you've got all this string section added and right. Guy Bark, you mentioned people like that as well, and John Mealing. And I mean, that got huge. But what are your memories of those three nights, right?
Three nights, yeah. I've got slightly mixed memories in a way, because mixed emotions, because I had started doing other things to earn money. So I was torn between, I want to do this all the time, but I also need to earn all the time. So there was this mix of things. And it was a big venture. That the vibe had changed a bit, because the stage was 100 times bigger. So I was, as you'll have seen, me and Chris, Guy and others were at the back, and it felt a bit more like we were sort of away from the core, the center, with the big string section and everything. And so it was slightly odd in that, yes, it was the biggest gigs we'd ever done, and it was phenomenally exciting and everything, but it didn't feel as close, if you like, a knit unit. It felt much more like a big show, and that's obviously what it was. But there was a different vibe to it, so I love it, and everything, don't get me wrong, but it was a different feeling to that which you know we'd had back in those sweaty sort of German small clubs.
And it's interesting because that never gets repeated, as like the scale of that, the size of the band, it immediately scales back down in a way afterwards as well, doesn't it?
That's right, exactly right. I did talk to Paul about that later on, and I think he felt at the time that was what he was hearing, and that's what he wanted to project, this sort of big sound, this big show. But I think you're right, very quickly after that didn't happen. It wasn't repeated. It was back down to the basics. Yeah, that's quite interesting. And that never happened really again, I don't think. So.
No. And even on some of it, it's just down to the four of them, isn't it? Steve, it's Mick and Paul, which is interesting. Obviously felt that maybe there was no further he could go with that kind of level.
Where can you go? Yeah. Something that's that big and it's that full orchestrally, sonically, you know, there's not a lot of space left. And I think Paul's that sort of writer who hears the space as much as he does the full-on sound,
Now let's talk, you mentioned the corporate side of things, so the music side of things since. There's a few things I've, myth or not, and this is fascinating. So playing on television theme tunes has been a thing.
Yeah, it was kind of the thing that put me off being a session player, actually, if I'm really honest with you.
I know, but one of them, every second counts, is a jingle of genius.
What a banger that was, yeah. I remember that really clearly, because it was in that period where I was thinking, I need to get some more money. I was thinking, do I get a job or don't I? And I got a call by one of the fixers. Again, you know, the phone, you have to sit there. Can you pop out to, is it Lime Grove or somewhere in the West London studio somewhere? Do a session. He didn't tell me what it was. So I walked into this session room, and kind of all of my session heroes were in the room. And I was thinking, whoa, okay, I've landed, you know. Mo Foster on bass. I mean, it was just a cooking band, you know. But they're all sitting around, not talking to each other, playing chess and reading books. And by the way, this is not derogatory comments to session players, because I was one. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Anyway, what is this thing that we're doing? Thinking, we, you know, this is the new kind of, I don't know, this is the new big British jazz invasion stuff. This is Ian Carter's Nucleus. We're going to be, you know, we're going to be cooking here. This is, what is this thing? Oh, it's the Paul Daniels at Every Second Counts theme tune. It's like, right. Okay. So, contestant number one walks on stage. Okay. Turn the page. Da-da, 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 da-da. Next one, contestant two. Okay. Now, listen, I've written stuff since. I've recorded jingles since. It's fine. But at the time, in my young brain, thinking, is this what it is then? Is this what I'm up? This is what's going to happen, is it? It just wasn't my thing. So that was one of my decision points in terms of, you know, of not staying in that highly competitive, obviously, session world. Yeah.
Now, the London circuit isn't a thing for you now. We were talking before the podcast, living in Hampshire, down on the South Downs. I mean, a beautiful part of the world, right?
Yeah. Absolutely love it. Yeah.
What was it that took you down that way?
I was born in Hampshire, then obviously went to London to get the action. And develop everything. And having kids, really, I think, just wanted to be somewhere other than there for them to grow up and everything. So eventually found our way into Hampshire, which kind of suits, because there's a great music scene down here anyway, locally, but there's also, I can be up in London and playing there if I want to quite quickly. So
that countryside, that area of outstanding natural beauty, we talked about this project, Walk Upon England, became a kind of inspiration for that creative project. So tell me about this meeting with Damien. Damien Montague.
Yeah, Damien and I were, actually, there's another friend of ours who's Hugh Bonneville, the actor.
Oh, yeah.
Locally. And there was a bunch of us dads who used to meet once every month in a pub in a local village, just because that's what we could do. You know, it was kind of boys' night out. And so I met Damien and Hugh and a few other people there. Really eclectic bunch of people. It's fantastic. I met Damien then. He and I got talking, and he, a great composer. He'd been doing a lot of TV and advertising and film work, and he'd written music for the Dome, if you remember that from,
all
those years ago. He'd written a Quiet Zone piece for the Dome, I think. Talented guy. And we got chatting, and he had got some ideas for some compositions that came to him while he was walking dogs on the South Downs, and he heard them as brass lines. And so he and I just got chatting, and we thought we'd be nice to do something together. He asked me to collaborate with him on these ideas. So we took the melody ideas that he was having in his wonderful studio that's in the South Downs, and orchestrated with a friend called Rob Sword. We put it all together, and we using the wonderful Tippett Quartet, string quartet, and I got a couple of brass friend players in to play as well. And it was just a lovely, lovely project that just was organic and grew out of Damien's compositions. And I wrote some brass parts and things. And we felt that it needed some words on it to sort of bring it to focus. And we were talking to Hugh about the project over a beer one night, and we said, I don't suppose you fancy reading some poetry on it, do you? You know? And he said, well, actually, I quite like the idea of writing some stuff for it. And we just thought, this could go either way, you know. Yeah. He's a friend. It's going to be like, yeah, that's really nice, but
that could be awkward.
He said, yeah, great, Philly Boots. So he did. And when he came back in and read what he'd written over the music, we were just floored. It was just stunning. So anyways, so we put that all together. We took it to a friend of ours. Damien's introduced us to Decca. Decca loved it and signed us.
Brilliant.
Okay, fantastic. So there we are in the South Downs. And then from there, we actually did it live a couple of times. We did a show at Glastonbury with it. We just like did a small version of it. Hugh hated Glastonbury because he was just spotted the whole time. So,
oh, God, yeah. I mean, this is, what, six, 7 years ago? So this is...
Yeah, that's right.
This is peak Downton Abbey time.
Peak Downton Abbey, yeah. Yeah, we did that. And actually, there's a Weller connection, which is really interesting, with this work, because we did two shows at the Chichester Festival Theatre So we wanted to do a live version of it, and we just thought, let's tell the story of the South Down. So Hugh wrote some other bits and pieces, pulled in a couple of actor friends. Christopher Timothy, one of them, lives locally.
Oh, brilliant.
So put together this whole evening of sort of South Downs-related art, music, poetry. Got a friend called Darren Black, who's a great guitarist, folk singer. This whole story, and the album key point, if you like, was the second half of the set. And Damien, Hugh and I were interviewed about it. We did a couple of shows there, and after the second night, I was just packing my horns away and sort of like coming down. Went to walk out to go and see my family and friends. Bumped into Anne Weller, who was backstage.
Wow.
Hello, Anne. It's like, oh, hello, Stuart. Yeah, very good. I like that. It was very nice. Thank you. Bye. I was like, well, hang on a second. What are you doing here? And she said, oh, I would like to keep check on my boys.
Oh.
That? I thought, wow, after all those years, I had kept in touch with her and Nikki, actually, primarily over the years. Nikki had kindly invited me and my son, Luke, who's a musician, backstage for certain things over time. And so I'd kept up with Anne a little bit. But she showed up at the festival theatre. And so we had a lovely chat. And she said, yeah, all right, bye then. Nice to see you. And off she went. So there was a sort of, that brought the sort of, I don't know, there's something sort of fatalistic about it. It was like, okay, I'm doing the right thing because here's something from my past, this connection that has worked. So yeah, it was a lovely period doing that. We did a second album after that without Hugh, without the words. In fact, the first album it makes me laugh when I say it, we went to number one in the classical charts, you know, and, yeah. And the single, the banging single of it, which, you know.
The Path Towards Tomorrow.
Yeah, very pastoral. Got to number one, you know, for about 30 seconds. I think we probably sold 5 copies in the classical world.
That's all you need these days, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely story, man. That's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun.
So what's now? Is there any more to come from that, or have we exhausted the South Downs?
Well, Damien and I were thinking about this the other day, actually. Someone had asked us to do a sort of a charity-related gig to raise funds for something or other, which we said we'd do, but it hasn't actually worked out. So it's still there. We still want to do a little bit more with it. It's got such a lot of legs. We've got ideas to take the scores, and I'm quite keen on brass education for young kids to help them understand why it's important to learn scales, which are not always the most obvious things to want to learn. So we're thinking about developing a sort of a musical education side of that. So that will continue. I've now taken sort of writing my own stuff. So I'm actually about to organize a studio session with some collaborator friends of my own stuff, which is quite sort of trumpet noir, I could think of. It's a bit sort of, if you know the theme tune for Homeland, sort of Sean Callery type, it's that kind of thing. So I'm just about to do that, which is great. But talking about local musicians here, so I recently hooked up with a guy called Jody Smith, who used to play, had done the odd gig with Van Morrison, lives locally. And also I got quite an interesting collaboration going with Culture Club sax player Steve Granger from back in the day, who lives just down the road from me too. So he and I are working on quite an interesting sort of jazz meets classical thing at the moment, which we're about putting together. But one thing that again pulls the whole council thing back into focus, which is quite interesting and has come up very recently. About a few years ago, Anthony Harty asked me to do a gig launching his album in Coventry. And so I went to do that, and he said, do a few council numbers. And it's a great band, actually. Had Horace from Specials on bass and some other guys, and Hillary Seabrook, well, Robertson, as she was in the first band, in the Café Bleu band. I'd never met her back in those days. So we got chatting, you know, and we kept in touch. And recently she said to me, I'd like to do some stuff. Why don't we get together and look at doing some stuff? And so you're the first person we've told this. I've told this, actually. But literally the last few weeks, we put together the Prosser Seabrook project.
Wow.
And we're working on some stuff. I'm really excited about it. We both are, because she's playing baritone. So it's got a kind of Jerry Mulligan meets Chet Baker. I don't know if you know any of those albums, the Mulligan Baker albums. That sound, which is this sort of glorious low Barry and the trumpet. We just started writing and recording demos. And so we're just thinking of that. We've got a call later on today to talk about how we develop it, who we might bring in to play it and stuff. So yeah, musically it's quite a lot.
That's fabulous. Well, I love getting an exclusive, as you'll know, on this podcast, but that is really exciting. And are you doing this in person? Is it over Zoom? How are you making it work?
It's in person. Yeah. It's in person. Yeah. Yeah. I've got a setup in my house where we can do all that. So Hillary's been down a few times. And the bizarre thing, even more bizarre, she used to live in the town I live in.
Your town sounds like Stella Street. Do you remember that TV show?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm not sure Michael Caine is twitching the curtains. Was that the same? No, maybe not. Maybe not. No, there, I mean, there really are. There are loads of... I think Noel Gallagher lives in a couple of villages along. Adele bought a house not that far. I said to Damien, you should go around and offer a cup of sugar or something. You know, does she need any milk? You know. Oh, by the way, I've got a studio.
Yeah. Got a couple of vocals that need doing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But, yeah, we're very, very lucky. It's a great part of the world. A lot of musical energy around here, which is just great.
Hey, look, well, that's all really exciting. As soon as you've got anything, please do share. We're going to launch this show, this podcast, as a Mixed Cloud music show as well, which is going to be all about new music. So new music from people with the Weller connections and stuff. So
right, well, there's a few things bubbling. We'd love that.
I have to ask you about your time in the Style Council, because it seems to me so much of it is these are really happy memories, like when we kicked off, and some really special people in that band and these relationships formed. But I'd love to, as this is an opportunity to talk about Chris, I'd love to get some thoughts on Chris, because Chris Lawrence was your bunkmate, right? And obviously, sadly, no longer with us. But yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to hear a bit about Chris.
No, well, thank you for asking, because he doesn't get a lot of airplay anymore. So he and I were in this Ryan the Quarter Boys band when I first moved to London, and immediately found a soulmate musically. He and I, the trombone trumpet combination, just he and I heard the same things, we listened to the same things, we'd dig out arrangements, let's say from Chicago or people like that, and we'd play them. In fact, I think we probably annoyed people on tour, but I remember in Japan, everyone else was sort of wandering around the city, and Chris and I were in our room blowing through Chicago horn line. Not for it, yeah, not all the time, but there was this sort of joy and pleasure in playing with him. We thought the same. We could go into studio. We did a lot of session work. We'd go into studio and work out parts. And sometimes we didn't even write them down. It just, you know, we could just play together. So it was great. Because originally I got the call from Dennis, and it was Billy and I in the horn section. And I said to Billy, you know what? I think it would be fantastic to have a trombone in the horn section, three piece. What do you think? And if he'd said, nah, because Paul hadn't used trombone on the recording, I don't think, before Cafe Bleu, certainly. Billy went, that's a great idea. So I introduced Billy to Chris. They got on. I said to Paul, would you fancy having a trombone in the horn section? And he said, oh, yeah, it could be interesting. Met Chris. We played. He went, yep, you're in. So Chris and I obviously had gone back. And so, yeah, so I ended up bunking with Chris, as you said, and spent a lot of time with him. He was a troubled individual. He had had quite a difficult childhood. That represented itself in different ways over the years. And he struggled with drinking and drugs later on. But he was just this superbly talented, energetic, focused musician. And when he was on, no one could touch him. You know, I mean, really. But like I said, that story on about him sort of squaring up to Paul, that's just him. You know, it was, you got all, he was either full on or full off. You know, it was kind of, And I loved him. He was, you know, he was not an easy person, but we were friends for a long time, and he went through loads of ups and downs. I think it didn't help after the Style Council, he joined the Stranglers, which is probably not a band known for its afternoon teas, you know. But what was lovely, actually, was after Chris passed away, his family got in touch with me and said, would I come and speak at the funeral, which I never expected. And so I did. And I said to him, I can tell some stories about his musical background, because most of his family had only seen him in his troubled later years. And he was still playing, he was doing a lot of jazz work and teaching and stuff in around Watford, but he hadn't really talked about his past at all. So at the funeral, it's a bit weird. His coffin was right there and it was really upsetting. But I told some stories. I mean, I told that one about Paul and him screwing off. I told the stories about other things that we got up to in the bands and things. But primarily I told them about what he had done, what he'd achieved, because I know that his family had found him so tricky later on. And loads of his nephews and nieces were there who knew nothing about any of this stuff at all. And so I tell them this, the stories, and afterwards they all came up to me and said, we didn't know Uncle Chris did that. He played in Dexys, Midnight Runners, which he did do before the council. He played with you. He played in the Stranglers. He did this and that. You know, they didn't know. Wow. So it was lovely being able to sort of bring him back to life for them. And in fact, on the way home, my wife and I, Elise, were sat in the car next to me, Googling on YouTube all the links from the Style Council stuff and bits and pieces, and just emailing it to his nephews and nieces who had no idea. They had no idea. So it was lovely kind of bringing his memory back. But I do miss him to this day. I mean, I've worked with some great trombonists, but he's still the best.
Well, thank you for sharing that, man. That's lovely. Hey, look, this has been such a delight hearing your stories and chatting with you. I've enjoyed it.
It's been such good fun. Tapping into those memories. It makes me want to pick up the phone to everybody again and say, let's go for a beer. You know, it's a Yeah, no, I do miss them. They're a good bunch of people. It's funny because I was only recently, I found all my memorabilia stuff, redecorating the house. I wanted to put some black and white pictures and frames up on this wall. And it was my wife's idea. She said, why don't you dig out your style council stuff? You never talk about it. You never kind of show it off. All right. So I dug it out. And actually, there's some lovely stuff, some programs that Mick and Paul had signed, bizarrely. Maybe I was going to give them to a friend or something, but I've still got them. T-shirts, backstage passes. Loads of photographs that I'd taken or I'd given to someone like Dave Liddell, who was Paul's roadie, to take, or Kenny, they'd take from the side of the stage. You know, I've got loads of these photos. I've got a photo of us. It was us locked in the waiting room of the station in Osaka because we got a police escort out of town after, you know, and there's all of us like a football team lined up. So I've got loads of photos like that, which is great. I found all this memorabilia, which is, again, only in the recent months. It's so funny all these things happening. It's just, you know, with keeping in touch with Nikki over the years, but then Anne turning up at the show I did, and then the Hillary connection, then you getting in touch and me finding Miss Memorabilia. And it's very odd, and it's in a nice way.
Now, look, this has been, so lovely. Thank you so much for coming on, Stuart. Really appreciate you telling your stories. I got two final questions for you before you go. So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. I don't even know if you're a fan of The Jam or Paul Weller solo, but, you know, it could be those, or it could be The Style Council.
Interesting question. I actually think I'd have to go for You're the Best Thing. And I'll tell you why, because it was actually, it's a great song, of course it is. But when my wife were planning our wedding, I didn't realize, but she loved the song. So we decided it would be the first song that was played for our slow dance, you know, after the ceremony. So I got it all lined up, fantastic, great day, lovely wedding, blah, blah. I got to the thing, said to the DJ, you can put the record on now. And he went, oh, I've left it at home. So we had to dance to Endless Love by Diana Ross, which is not the same, I can tell you. But actually, interestingly, she does have the words "You're the best thing" inscribed on the inside of her wedding ring. So I haven't told anybody that before either.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, wedding DJ, you've got one job, man. Come on.
But also, I'd known this guy for hundreds of years. He used to, when this other band was in London, around quarters, he would be our DJ, you know, so he knew me back to front. It's like,
Maybe the pressure got to him, who knows. And look, final question. So the purpose of this podcast is, I mean, really, it's to hear all the stories from amazing people like yourself about your careers and your links with Weller and all that. But I got to be honest, the reason we started it is for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. If it happens, what should I ask him?
I've heard some of the questions. I'd say to this, Paul, Mayfield or Marriott?
Oh.
And I'm not talking hotel groups.
It took me a while to work out. For a split second, I was like, Mayfield, wait. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, okay. As an influence, Curtis Mayfield, Steve Marriott. I just would love to hear his thoughts on that, because I think those two, from an influence perspective, that just, you can hear so much of both of them in his stuff. And I'd just be interested to know which way he would lean.
And there was the Curtis Mayfield connection with the style cast, wasn't there? He mixed one of the tracks on the Cost of Loving LP.
Yes, that's right.
But yeah, that's a great question, man. That's cool. I must write all these down, you know.
Well, hopefully you've recorded them, haven't you?
I know, but I've now got to listen back to every single podcast because I'm so stupid. Yeah. I've not read a note.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
What an idiot.
When you do get to meet him, you're gonna be so, your head's gonna be so full of like 400 questions, you probably won't get one out, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's also like I won't need any of my own questions because I've got all yours.
No, exactly.
Brilliant. And if he doesn't like the question, I can blame it on you lot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I would never have asked that, Paul, honestly.
Stuart, thank you so much for your time. Do keep in touch. Let us know what's coming next. And we will share on the social media and all that. But thanks so much for joining me, man.
Thank you, Dan. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been really lovely channeling that period again and talking to you and meeting you too. Thank you.
My thanks once again to Stuart Prosser, another brilliant honorary counsellor, the Style Council, an incredible brass musician and arranger as well. Check out the show notes for this podcast on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Lots of links on there to songs, a playlist, details about what he's been doing more recently as well, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're there, you can show your support by heading to my store, exclusive merchandise in there. Plus, you can sign up by a virtual coffee as well, a one-off or a subscription. We love it all. On the roll call this week, my thanks to Andy Kay, who says, always a great listen. One day you might get to interview Paul Weller. Smiley face.
Thanks, mate. Hi to Steve Perry. Cheers to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to Peter Cook. Thanks as well. Hello to Mark from Perth in Western Australia, who says, been here from the start. Love all the guests. It can't be too long, Dan, before you get the interview with the great man. Well, fingers crossed, Mark, you never know. Hello to Andy Tolcher. Thanks for your virtual coffee. Hi to Martin Morrow. Hello to Brian G. Alex McLaughlin, thank you, sir, who says, Virginia Turbot, another great episode. Someone else in Weller's orbit whose name I wasn't familiar with, but what a lovely and interesting guest. It's what it's all about, Alex. Hello to Steve Perry. Thanks for your virtual coffee. Hi to Mike Steer. Much appreciated. Thanks to you as well. Cheers to all of you for your virtual coffees. Do head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com, if you want to get involved. And make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon Alexa, Acast, and more. You'll also find me on social media as well. Get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod or on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.